Hi, and welcome to Climate Tracker Weekly, where we hear stories that matter to young climate journalists around the world. I'm your host, Chris Wright. Growing up in Bangalore, widely regarded as the Silicon Valley of India, Seema Prasad initially wanted to become a software engineer, but ended up following in the footsteps of her parents, who are both journalists. At the age of 19, she was already in her first journalism internship and since then has studied at the Times School of Journalism in Delhi and believes that climate change has a massive untapped potential in what is the world's biggest print journalism market. With over 100,000 newspapers across 21 languages and over a billion readers, Seema is passionate and hopeful about the future of climate journalism in India, even in what seems to be a shifting political climate. Seema, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And how are things with you now? Where are you calling from?
So I'm calling from Bangalore, India. It's in the southern part of India.
Okay, and what's Bangalore like right now? Is it a big city? Is it a hot city? Like, can you describe it for us?
So Bangalore is the Silicon Valley of India. It's where a lot of the tech companies are set up. We have a lot of techies. It is an expanding city. Initially, it was called the Pensioner's Paradise of India, where there was a lot of greenery and, no traffic, no pollution. But now things have changed with a lot of development and the pollution levels have soared. And we have the most number of vehicles in the whole of India. I mean, we have compared to all the other cities, we have the most vehicular population.
Very interesting. And how do the techies feel about this kind of population boom?
So they are the reason we have the population boom because we have a lot of migrants from all across India coming to work here, whether it's in the tech sector or whether it's like, you know, for construction work or you know, the other sectors, the industries. So we do have a mix of people, you know, it's very cosmopolitan.
Sure.
So usually every state in India has its own designated language. But in Bangalore, we speak like most of the languages. Like you can get away with English if you don't really need to know any of the Indian languages.
Okay. And could you also get away with like Tamil or Bengali?
Sure. You can get away with Tamil. There are a lot of Tamilians in Bangalore, but Bengali, I don't think so, because that's a very that's very specific to West Bengal.
Okay.
And that's that's an East Indian state. Southern India is very mixed. We have people from different parts of Southern India staying different parts. So, you know, that's different.
Fair enough. Well, I'd love to kind of learn a little bit more about you. So we've talked a little bit about the history of Bangalore, but I'd love to learn a little bit about you. You've obviously been a proud resident of Bangalore for a while, so I'm guessing the city shaped part of your life, but you're also a young journalist. You know, you've been in the journalism game for a little while, but how did that all start?
So it basically started with me not being good at math and science. So I didn't really get very high marks in English, but my English teacher, you know, somebody who I would have written something for, they would always, you know, give me a compliment saying, hey, you know, that was good, or, you know, that was interesting. You know, they would always sort of, encourage my writing. So it started from there. And then I took media for my undergraduate degree. And so during the course of the degree, we had to do a couple of internships. And one of my internships was with a newspaper. And so it just, you know, it just organically started from there. And then I did my post-graduation as well in journalism in Delhi. And after that, I got hired by the Indian Express as a trainee. So I was a trainee for like 6 months. And then I worked as a staff reporter for a website that writes about civic issues in Bangalore for about 8 to 9 months. Mm. And then I joined International Business Times, and they have a subsidiary called Medical Daily. So I worked with them as a freelance health reporter for nearly 2 years. Yeah, so that's been my journey so far.
It's an interesting journey. You've worked with kind of a range of different publications.
Yeah.
I'd love to know about those first couple of years. I imagine that things in all industries in India must be highly competitive, but journalism must be very, very competitive, particularly English language market journalism, because there must be just so many great young English speaking writers in India. And by so many, I mean like thousands upon thousands. Do they work you incredibly hard in those first few years?
Yeah, it's very competitive, you're right. And there is a lot of, you know, work that needs to be done in the first few years. And on average, you're expected to produce at least one story a day. So, I mean, is that the average in other countries as well? I don't know.
I think it depends. I mean, my friends in Malaysia, some of the publications used to put them on three a day. But the kind of quality wouldn't necessarily be kind of such a focus.
Yeah.
And such
like- so in my last job, I had to do a minimum of like two a day.
Okay. And so, and how do you do two a day for people who aren't journalists? Like, can you break that down in terms of hours? How do you wake up in the morning and get two done before the end of the day?
So it was, so they need, so they need not be, you know, completely original. It can be, so we're just feeding the beast of the internet and, you know, getting the views and stuff like that. But of course, the writing is original. Maybe the idea isn't. So it's just about being smart and, you know, figuring out what is trending and, you know, picking out the right news for that day and just sort of writing it in a way that makes sense to people. So, yeah, so I think the way to do many articles is to write a few words, you know, like keep your limit like 300 words. So if you write about 200 to 300, then you can write as many articles as you want.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. And I think I've heard stories of people working in BuzzFeed in the early years kind of pumping out like, you know, 8-9 stories a day because they're like, you know, 200 words, have a coffee, 200 words, get another coffee kind of thing. A lot of young journalists, though, think of themselves as, I want to write Nat Geo stories. I want to write Times kind of long form investigative stories and break, you know, incredible stories of corruption and crime and politics and things, and might feel like sitting in an office and pumping out two a day is kind of demeaning. It's not what they really wanted to get into. Do you think it's still a valuable experience?
Yeah, definitely. Because one, it helped improve my writing skills. And I think I was an average writer when I first started with Medical Daily. I think now I'm slightly above average, maybe. I still don't know if I'm very good, but I try. So I think it gave me a lot of practice in terms of framing the story, in terms of, you know, selecting the right photographs and giving the right headlines. So that always helps, because when once you do, you know, a lot of investigation, at the end of the day, it's about how you compress that information into a few pages. So it's always, you know, good to learn how to present your story. So yeah, I think that's the skill I learned the most.
I totally agree. And it's funny how you describe it as like, it's almost like grinding through it. Like you know, some startup people, they say you should kind of move fast and break things. In a way, you know, those kind of early years of your journalism career, it kind of sounds a bit like that, because you have to just kind of move fast and learn how to kind of get better with your writing and with your headlines and with your structuring. Did you find yourself kind of on a daily basis feeling like you're improving, or did you just kind of at times just feel like you were in this kind of black hole of, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm just pumping out kind of mindless stuff?
I don't know what to say considering my last employer might be listening.
Okay. So. Well, I mean, motivation wise, did you get a sense of I'm improving, or is it kind of hard to understand that?
So I don't think, I noticed it immediately. I think, I just, you know, sort of went back to my previous stories from when I started as an intern, like, you know, when I was 19 to when I was last year. And just in terms of research and, you know, there was a significant improvement that naturally happens over the years. So I did feel like I was in a grind, and I did feel like, actually I went through this huge moral crisis. You know, like this existential crisis of what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And, you know, because of the grind. And I did feel like, you know, because some of it wasn't original, I did feel really demotivated at times as well. So while I was in a black hole trying to figure things out, I also, you know, somehow managed to do the stories I wanted to as well. So it wasn't like I just, you know, gave up and only did the, you know, stories required to get the views. So I did, if I wanted to, I would write long articles as well. But since the website was targeting US audiences, and since I'm based in Bangalore, it is very difficult to write completely original stories.
Sure.
So I think the way to write original stories from India for the US is to, like, you know, dig up a lot of research. And a lot of research sometimes doesn't get mentioned in the mainstream publications, whether it's the New York Times or wherever. So since I am very research oriented, I would, dig up some interesting study and, you know, like, kind of frame it my own way and, you know, somehow make it work for myself. So those were the, things that helped me get through the last 1.5 to 2 years with IBT.
And did you have kind of journalistic idols or journalistic, like, even mentors that were helping you through that process?
It was a freelance job that was paid per article. So I did not have anyone. So I was working on my own, dealing with the whole thing on my own, actually. So I did not have any mentors to talk to or anything like that. So I just somehow made my way out of it.
That sounds like a pretty tough job, and you're working hard on your own. But across your journey, you know, you started when you're 19, you're now 28. Who have you looked up to, maybe ever since you were 19, as the kind of journalistic icons of India that you kind of really are amazed at their work?
So right now I'm amazed by a lot of health journalists in India. There are way too many to name. So I think the amount of risks that they put themselves through to go to hospitals, meet people, talk to patients, doctors, considering our numbers, and, you know,
you're talking about COVID, right?
Yeah, COVID. Yeah. So I think I'm very inspired by the health reporters doing their work right now, not the TV health reporters, because that's just like, you know, a bulletin of, like, what's happening in the day. Mm-hmm. But I think the online health reporters, you know, are really doing a really great job. And I hope to do that soon.
Yeah, you're going to kind of try to go chasing ambulances and run into hospitals and try to report on what's going on?
Yeah, that's the plan.
Well, I hope it comes true. Seema, you're obviously now diving into environmental journalism as well. Why did you want to get involved in environmental reporting?
So I think I was already writing about health before. And so it's like, it's you know, it's kind of related. I wouldn't say it's the same thing. They're two different things. But, you know, it's all connected. I mean, the reason, there are so many lung cancer cases in the world and so many of the diseases that are there today, including COVID, are due to environmental changes. So that's one of the reasons, because I feel like, I do have an insight into health and environment. And then the other reason is personally, because so I live in Bangalore. And so the temperature in Bangalore was and the weather in Bangalore was very, very different when I was growing up. So, for instance, it was very pleasant. You know, the summers were great. You could just wear dresses and, you know, just relax, chill around. But now summer is like, we need the AC. We need, like, an air cooler. And, you know, and you can't sleep at night. And you have, like, you need the fan and the window. And, you know, everything is just, like, changed. So from moderate, it became extreme weather in a matter of, like, 20 years. And I lived through the weather change. So I realized that, you know, this is something that is important and needs to be highlighted. And this is, you know, something that needs more attention in the media. So I think that's where, I guess that's one of the reasons as well.
You talked about, you know, how things have changed over time. And obviously you can feel the temperature. Do you also see it on a kind of a broader societal level? Do you feel like people are now having conversations in Bangalore and across India around the environment, around climate change that they weren't having maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And I obviously say this in the context of a lot of people outside of India, you know, basically interpret India's approach to the environment through the lens of Narendra Modi or through the lens of whoever happens to be in power. We don't often hear about what everyday Indians feel around kind of the environment and climate change. So what is the kind of the word on the street about climate change in Bangalore?
So in Bangalore, it is very, very obvious to anyone who comes here that, you know, there has been a shift in the weather conditions. There is a lot of pollution. So if you were to, you know, if you were to travel anywhere in Bangalore, you would definitely, you know, choke on the fumes, and, you know, you would, it's very evident, you know, there's no need to like, you know, it's very much something that is spoken about on a daily basis. You know, complaining about the traffic is something that all Bangaloreans do. It's like a joke now, you know. So everyone is very, very concerned about the pollution in India. So most Indians are very aware of what climate change is. There are a lot of journalists as well in India who write about climate change. And I think, you know, the word on the street, I would say, is that Indians are aware. They know that, you know, things have changed. They know, especially because the monsoons, which were more frequent earlier, have we don't get as many rains as we used to. And there is a lot of drought in the country. There is, you know, a shift in the agricultural patterns. For instance, I think, I think in 2011, I don't know the exact year, 50% of our economy depended on agriculture, and now it has come down to 15%. So even economically, you know, people are feeling it. And the reason being, I mean, the livelihoods of farmers are dependent on the weather conditions. And since they are 50% of our workforce, and they're even currently protesting now, so most farmers and most people are very, very aware of what climate change is. And it's something that is written about on a daily basis, spoken about, a lot of awareness. Everyone wants to do something about it.
And is it spoken about and written about in non-English dailies? And I say this because obviously India is a country with, you know, thousands of different publications with dozens of languages. And a lot of the media that people get outside of India is based on what the Times of India wrote, or based on, you know, the Indian Express, or, you know, the Hindustan Times and stuff. It's not necessarily based on what the majority of Indians are reading when they kind of open up the newspaper in the morning or turn on the radio. So do you find that there's differences in the reporting based on English or non-English or Hindi or non-Hindi based publications?
Okay, so since I'm an English speaker, and I would consider English my first language, Hindi and English, I would say, are my first and second language. But I think there is, you know, I think they are writing equally. But, you know, I wouldn't know it for a fact because I don't consume regional daily. So I wouldn't know it for a fact. But I think that most journalists are aware, whether it's regional or, you know, English speaking. So.
Okay, well, it's interesting that even kind of within India, obviously, there could be so much diversity that you might not be able to say for sure what's going on in kind of a particular language publication. When I'd probably consider you, you know, as close to, you know, somewhat of an expert as you could get. I mean, you're obviously not a media professor, but as someone who works in the field, it's very interesting to hear you say that you're not necessarily sure.
Yeah, so that's because, I mean, my whole goal is to learn the English language the best possible way I can. So I wouldn't know. Yeah, that is interesting because, so like, you know, for instance, so both my parents speak English to me at home, but their backgrounds, as in their mother tongue. So my father speaks Telugu, which is a language spoken in Andhra Pradesh, which is a South Indian state. And my mother speaks Memni, which is a language spoken in Western India, Gujarat. So both my parents speak completely different languages to their families, but the common ground that they, I mean, the common language that they both know is English. So they speak to me in English as well. So the language, so we don't speak in any other, you know, language other than English in my house. Even though my parents do in their, you know, while they were growing up, they had their own sort of languages that they learned, but I somehow didn't, I mean, you know, I went to like a private school and, you know, my whole upbringing has been very different. So.
No, it's fascinating. And it's kind of, you know, I think it just, for me, it rings true at the scale of kind of things that happen within, you know, this country that we call India. It just kind of, I honestly think that in Australia, you could, for example, know what is going on in different publications in different states, and if you wanted to, and just the idea that, you know, there might be so much diversity and so much kind of media output in a country like India that it might be impossible to really have a full understanding of what's going on, you know, from one person. You might need a whole team of dozens of people to kind of actually get together and really have a sense of what's going on.
Yeah, I think we should do somebody should, you know, study if the regional dailies are, you know, really reporting on climate change as much as they should. Somebody should probably, you know, take up that research and, you know, do a proper analysis of that.
Well, Seema, I mean, you know, maybe that somebody is a conversation we can have straight after this. I mean, it's I'd love to do a piece of research like that. We did some research a couple of years ago, maybe back in 2015, 2016, but that's certainly going to be out of date by now. I'm sure plenty of those publications have shut down or got new names or whatnot. So I think that would be really great to do. And obviously you talked about pollution being a key issue in Bangalore and across India.
So one of the issues is the pollution of the Bellendur Lake. So this lake basically is located in an area where there are a lot of industries. And so because of the effluents that, you know, get deposited in Bellendur Lake, there has been foaming, you know, like the lake has started erupting in like flames and foams, and you know, and that is going into people's houses through the sewage networks and causing issues for them, and that is under litigation, and they are trying to you know, form, I mean, I think there is a committee already looking into that, but you know, nothing concrete has been decided as of now. So the Bellendur Lake foaming issue, like everybody, even the international media has picked up on it. So you can like read about it.
Oh, for sure. And I wonder if we could kind of jump back to the question of the farmers. You mentioned, you know, that agriculture has, you know, taken a massive shift in terms of its focus within the Indian economy over the last couple of years. And obviously right now, a number of farmers, you know, tens of thousands of farmers, are protesting in Delhi and have been protesting, I understand, for about 3 months now. Can you describe that protest at the moment? And can you kind of, do you think there's any links to some of the environmental shifts that we've seen over the last couple of years?
Yeah, definitely. So I think right now what the farmers are doing is they have decided now to camp out there until the government, you know, meets their demands. So they have set up tents, you know, they've set up electricity lines, they've, you know, formed medical camps, and they've decided to, you know, stay put. And they have even, you know, sort of distributed the work amongst themselves. Like, you know, for instance, like one member of a family would probably stay in the tent while the others would go tend to the farmland back in their villages. And then, so while keeping the work distributed, they have also, you know, decided to, like, for instance, if, you know, I'm your friend, and you want to protest along with your family, so then I make a deal with you that, okay, when I go back to the village, I'm going to go and tend to your land as well. So they want to keep their produce going back in the villages while protesting in the capital. So they're doing it simultaneously, you know, so while some of them work back home, the others, ensure that they stay put and they're, you know, driving their message across to the government. And I don't see them stopping this, silent protest anytime soon, because they want nothing short of the government changing the three laws that they passed. So basically, a lot of crops in India, sometimes cannot be grown, or, and they don't give much profit to the farmers, because either there's a lot of rain, or there's no rain, or there's heat, or there are pests, and there are floods, and there are droughts. And, that affects the earnings of the farmers, and that affects their livelihoods as well. So while we don't know for sure whether, climate change, we can't directly establish a link between climate change and the productivity of the fields. I mean, there's no denying that there is probably some connection for sure.
If you compare Indian farmers to many other countries, I think the Indian government identifies 98% of Indian farmers as being basically kind of poor. And that's based on submissions to the World Trade Organization, that there are kind of such a small population of Indian farmers that are kind of doing financially very well. Whereas you might think of farmers in like the United States or other countries that have massive plots and have kind of, multiple millions of dollars worth of land and such like that. And I feel like the story might be slightly different for farmers in India. And that, any shift in seasonal productivity really is a difference, not just between, being kind of very rich and relatively rich, but also is a difference between, being very, very poor and kind of, potentially being extremely poor. Do you feel that is somewhat reflective in these protests that we're seeing, that there is this kind of, not just a kind of a push to protect farmers as an industry, but also kind of class elements here that obviously would play out if environmental conditions change?
Yeah, for sure. So I need to tell you a little bit of background about the protest. So basically, there's something called the minimum support price. So the minimum support price is like a predetermined price at which certain crops and goods have to be sold. And that predetermined price is what gets is what they depend on, because otherwise, if they had to go with market rates, or if private companies decided the rates of their products, then they probably wouldn't get the minimum guaranteed price. So one of the laws that was brought in September wanted to remove, I mean, not exactly wanted to remove the minimum price, but the farmers suspect that this would have an impact on the minimum price that has been guaranteed to them right now. So eventually they think that, it would be very hard to regulate, and the only people who will benefit from privatization of farming is are the rich farmers, because the rich farmers are already in the business, they're already doing well, and they are a small percentage, like you said. So I think the only people who stand to benefit from the farm laws that were recently passed are the rich farmers. And the poor farmers who don't have access to transportation, who don't have much bargaining power, or they don't have much independence, and they're still struggling in terms of technology, and they don't have the right resources to grow the crops they need. So since they're already struggling, and since majority of our farmers are poor, privatization of farming, won't really benefit most of them, because I think what most of them are afraid of is the corporatization of the entire farming process. Well, right now, most of the laws are regulated by the government, and everything from pricing to trade, everything is regulated by the government. So by making it a free market, it's going to put a lot of their livelihoods at risk.
Absolutely. And how do you see that playing out with some of the environmental shifts that we see in India right now?
it's not for me to personally say, but how will it play out? I mean, it is very difficult to say right now because, I mean, it's become like this whole political thing right now, you know. Environmentally, I think it would be a disaster because I don't think that they can grow as much as the private sector needs. I think they would need to be subsidized at a cost that could, you know, keep them going at the, you know, current state. But I mean, even being in the current state is quite bad as well because they're not doing very well. So I think the current farming models have to be changed, and there has to be a lot of research and inspection, and people have to figure out something new that, you know, that works for the farmers as well as the private sector. They can come to some kind of negotiation and figure out what works for both sides. It would make sense. But right now there's a deadlock, you know. So, and the government is very, very adamant on their laws, and the farmers don't want to budge from what they think is right. So right now there's just like this cold war at the capital, at the border of the capital, and so I don't know, you know, how this is going to play out. But environmentally, it would make sense if they could reach some sort of compromise.
Okay. And one of the stories that has come out of these farmers' protests is the story of Disha Ravi, the 22-year-old. Obviously, I think she's also from Bangalore as well, right?
Yeah, correct.
And my understanding of the story is that she effectively shared a document that was being passed around some international climate folks.
Yeah.
And that sharing of a document on WhatsApp, I believe, was basically kind of enough to trigger what sounds like a bit of a federal response. So it sounds like people kind of from another state drove in, picked her up, drove her back to Delhi, and then kind of has kind of gone through this crazy court case. Can you describe, you know, that whole event, and can you describe, you know, how that felt as another young Bangalorean woman kind of hearing that story?
So she studied in Mount Carmel College, where a lot of my friends have studied as well. And that's a very well-known college in Bangalore. And she just passed out last year, I think. So as a student of journalism and as a student who, you know, wanted to, you know, make a change. So, you know, that did hit home very hard. So apart from that, I think what happened, you know, was, you know, not very constitutional. It did violate a lot of her human rights, and you know, they didn't follow the, you know, the correct legal procedures that is required in this situation. If they did suspect, you know, that she was trying to incite violence, or, you know, whatever the or whether she was you know, trying to you know, conspire against the government, there is no proof of that. In fact, even the Delhi court, she was given bail on February 22nd. And so usually what happens in such cases is you have to inform your local police of such an arrest, and the local police has to translate this complaint in the local language and keep it in their diary at the local police station. So this did not happen in this case. They sort of flew her directly. They showed up at her house, I think, on a Saturday. And that's when the magistrate courts are closed in Bangalore. So she could not be, you know, they could not take her to a magistrate court to get permission. Instead, they didn't even give her the right to choose her own lawyer. She was given a lawyer, but it wasn't the lawyer of her choice. But later on, I think she did get, eventually she did get the legal recourse that she wanted. But initially she wasn't given the choice of her own lawyer, which again doesn't make sense. So the Delhi court, which granted her bail on February 22nd, actually said very clearly that there is no proof of sedition. There is no proof of the intention to create disorder from the toolkit. So this toolkit was first shared by Greta Thunberg on her Twitter account. And then I think that was on February 3rd, and then she deleted it. And then another version of the toolkit was shared once again on February 4th. So the edited version of the toolkit said something about the farmers' protests. It said that on January 26th, when there were protests in Delhi, which resulted in some violence, it said specifically that protesters should gather near the Indian embassy, the media houses, and at corporate offices all across the world. And since that's exactly what happened on that day, and since that's what the toolkit is saying, so they kind of so the police seem to think that both are that she's somehow connected with the Delhi incident, because a toolkit in general just refers to various protests that can happen anywhere. So it can be the Occupy Wall Street protest, which also had a toolkit. Then there was also the Black Lives Movement, which had a toolkit. And all of these toolkits were just like, a step-by-step guide on, what slogans to say and what placards to hold, and like basic things like where to protest and, things like that, what is being protested, just like standard operating procedure, nothing complicated. So it didn't really say anything besides how to protest and what to protest. It didn't say anything about inciting violence. It didn't say anything about, causing disharmony amongst communities, among religious groups, or causing ill will between people. It said nothing like that. And even the court has ruled, has said the same thing. The Delhi court that granted her bail said the exact same thing. So right now, and editing a document does not equal to, she did edit her, what they're saying is she edited a part of it. And that part seems like, that could have led to a conspiracy, but editing, just merely editing a toolkit cannot equal to, a conspiracy against a nation. It's not equivalent, one is not equivalent to the other. So I think that so right now she's been granted bail, and they told her not to leave the country and that they're going to continue to investigate her. And apart from her, there are two others named in these with the same charges, some of her colleagues. So they were granted bail before they were arrested, so she was given a non-bailable warrant. And so so her colleagues went to the Bombay court and applied for bail beforehand. So, but she wasn't given the option of bail beforehand. And what a lot of lawyers are saying is that if they wanted to just check her communication with Greta Thunberg and other international organizations, then they just had to investigate her devices, check her mobile phone history and, her communication on WhatsApp. They just had to do stuff like that. They didn't need to interrogate her and keep her there for so long. So it does seem like, some kind of intimidation on the part of the government. So they do have their reasons for sure. Because one person did die on January 26th, a farmer, his tractor overturned and he died. So they do have a reason to get worried, but at the same time, it doesn't seem like it's being done at, in the way that it should, following all legal and constitutional procedures that they should, that this situation requires, especially since she's only 22. And she's just been a peaceful protester up to now. And she literally is just somebody who works at a vegan company.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's kind of incredible levels of detail that you've obviously kind of been studying this case quite specifically. I wonder, how does this make you feel as someone who, is a young journalist, potentially, wants to be able to write and express yourself in any way that you feel is truthful. And, this is pretty clearly a moment where someone doing the same thing has basically had, an incredible amount of pressure put on her, whether or not she's now free, which I understand, the court has effectively said that there is no case for sedition or criminal conspiracy, but I understand that process is still ongoing. But as someone who is kind of watching this happen to someone who is very similar to herself, How does that make you feel as a young journalist? Does that make you worried about your future in the profession?
Yeah. One of the reasons I'm worried is because a lot of the some journalists who were covering the farmers' protests were actually arrested as well. So I think it was last month, January, towards the end of January, there was this journalist. I think his name was Mahip Punia. He was a freelancer for the Caravan, and he was arrested. And so, I mean, he was just doing his job, you know, at the border. He was just like speaking to people and asking them, you know, what's happening and things like that. So, and he was arrested as well. So, and I think there have been about 5 arrests of journalists in the month of January. This, yeah, and apparently this is the most, I think since 92, since the year 92, no other year has recorded more than 4 journalists being arrested in India. So apart from these 5 arrests, they have also given arrest warrants to a lot of other journalists, and some of them have also been, there have been sedition charges against them as well. And so they actually, the government also, so the Caravan is like this long form magazine in India that does a lot of, investigation into the government policies and things like that. So they shut down the Twitter account of Caravan magazine. And they shut down the Twitter accounts of a lot of journalists and people who they thought were, you know, threatening the peace of the country. Yeah. So they have directly targeted journalists many times already in the last 1 or 2 months. So I do feel that, you know, if for instance, I wanted to read the toolkit. I think a lot of journalists have read and paraphrased many parts of it, but I was just scared to like access it. You know, what if I, you know, by mistake, you know, it's apparently a Google document. So what if I'm like looking through a Google document, my cursor accidentally goes somewhere, and you know, by mistake, I'm, when you're looking through a document, you can sort of, you know, press backspace and edit something, or by mistake, you know, when it is scrolling through tons of material. Yeah. So I was just scared to even open that document and read it, because I don't know, tomorrow somebody might charge me with criminal conspiracy. So, I mean, she edited the document, right? So that's all she did. So, and she shared it as well. But I mean, considering the number of arrests and, there is a lot of, the government under Narendra Modi is trying to suppress the media to much more than before. So, I mean, but I don't think that's going to stop me from, covering the things I want, because I'm going to ensure that, you know, I present both sides to each story. I'm not going to be biased in any way. I'm not going to let my political opinions come through in any story. I'm going to be as balanced as I possibly can. And if there is, when we write a story on a medical study, we at the end of the study, I mean, at the end of the story, we always write about the, side effects of taking that particular drug, or, you know, we always balance it out. So I think as long as I'm balanced and, I do my job well, and, you know, I have the required documentation for whatever I'm writing about. So, I mean, I don't think, I'm particularly worried per se, because I've never written anything extremely controversial so far. And plus, the protests are happening in Delhi and I live in Bangalore. So I'm a bit removed from that whole situation to be directly affected by it. But in terms of what
Disha Ravi could have said the same thing on February 12th, though.
That's correct. Yeah. That is true. I mean, you have a point. But it's hard to say, you know, all we can do is do our job the best way we can and, you know, do the right thing.
It's interesting what you said just now, and I think this might be kind of a nice way to end it off. You know, in American journalism, and obviously I think America takes up so much of our global media space in terms of our attention, probably much more so than the amount of websites. But in American media, you've seen this very clear shift towards almost owning a lack of neutrality as a reporter, almost owning your kind of vested interest or your biases in your journalism, being very upfront about it and saying, you know, as a Democrat or as a person from this community, I want to write this way. And that's important. And what you were describing in your kind of journalism is this almost dedication to neutrality, a dedication to not revealing your biases. Do you feel that American kind of trend might be something that kind of becomes more normal in India? Or do you feel that what you were describing, that commitment to neutrality, is something that will continue to be a clear element of Indian journalism?
So I think Indian journalism has already been divided into, pro BJP and anti BJP. You know, that's already been divided. Like, all the channels clearly have their stance.
BJP is clearly the party of Narendra Modi.
Yeah, so there is already a very clear divide among every paper, amongst everybody. You know, there is neutrality. I mean, there are a few journalists who are neutral, but there has been a very clear divide established already. So we are already, we're already there. So I think we're almost the same as the American media in terms of our biases. But I mean, the neutrality I spoke of was from a legal standpoint, because you asked me how I felt about it. So I think that I think more people should try to be more, neutral and not take sides. So I think being neutral is important. But when in certain cases, like, you know, the Disha Ravi issue, it's very hard to be neutral in this situation.
Hmm.
Yeah. So
why is it hard?
Because there were no, constitutional procedures followed. They, kept her in custody for like 9 days. They didn't give her the lawyer that she wanted, things like that. So that is when they make it impossible for us to be neutral, then, that's where I think journalists struggle with most. Because when the situation is so bad, I mean, how do you be neutral, right? That's like an existential question that I still don't know the answer to.
So, well, Seema, obviously kind of it really pained me to read about Disha Ravi's story. And I personally can't imagine what it must be like to be a young journalist, kind of knowing that that's your government doing that to people who are so similar to yourself, your own hometown, went to a school that friends of yours went to. So I really feel for you. But are you still hopeful as a young journalist in India, in Bangalore? Do you still have hope for the future, or has some of that hope been diminished a little bit?
No, because, I mean, finally the court did grant her bail and said that, there wasn't any evidence. So I guess, what's the saying, truth triumphs all or something. So, as long as journalists seek out the truth and put it out there, I don't see, anything happening to, the profession. I'm quite hopeful for the future.
Well, that's a beautiful perspective on it. And I really hope that sense of strength that you have continues into the future. And I can't wait to read your next story is coming out. Thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you so much for sharing, your life, your experiences, your city, and I can't wait to kind of see what you do next.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for the show. I'm Chris Wright, and this is Climate Tracker Weekly. For comments, suggestions, and feedback, you can email us at podcast@climatetracker.org. Join us again next time for another episode of Climate Tracker Weekly.